A fallen god, Surya. At the border between the hot and cold hells, there was a being who appeared dazed and exasperated at his plight. His feet, legs, and genitals were frozen solid, while his abdomen, chest, arms, and head were engulfed in a blue-yellow flame that overwhelmed his form. "I should not be here. Don't they know who I am?" he bellowed at the top of his lungs. "I am Surya, Lord of the Sun. My life in the realm of pleasure and bliss is supposed to be eternal. What am I doing here? I have been worshipped by humanity for aeons. I am honored by all the other gods. I am supreme." His voice cracked. "There is something wrong. Something is very wrong here." Nobody was listening. Surya was alone in the zone of hell into which gods fall after they succumb to inevitable death following eons of heavenly enjoyment. Countless former gods were writhing in agony around him. He felt nothing but disgust and disdain for them because they could only think of themselves instead of serving him. In his own mind, he was the supreme one. His anger at being ignored only caused him more heat and more pain. Somehow my presence caught his eye, and he gestured for my attention. When I nodded in assent, he began to tell his story. "Long, long ago, in very ancient times, I was a celebrated stonemason and sculptor for the ultra-wealthy. I had worked extremely hard building sacred structures, and having perfected my craft, I became a master mason. In time, I discovered that the forms I had created had a profound effect on my patrons and other viewers of my works. They said that the likeness of the gods I sculpted seemed so impeccable that I must be the possessor of rare and esoteric cosmic secrets. For many years, spectators praised my work as being great, glorious, and sublime. I began to wonder if they could be right. Perhaps my greatest work was a huge marble temple dedicated to the divine, which had been sponsored by a following of my most admiring patrons. Thousands of men and women volunteered to help me create this wondrous temple. They were only too happy to do my bidding, and the benefactors were pleased to pour their wealth into so worthy a project. Finally, after many years, the temple was completed, and the day for consecration was determined by the astrologers, the summer solstice. The astrologers suggested that to commemorate the day, it would be auspicious to name the building Surya Mandir, Temple of the Sun. When the rising sun illuminated the temple, the awestruck spectators expressed deep gratitude to me for having created such a magnificent structure. The principal benefactor rose from the audience and gave a speech lauding my divine inspiration. He declared that I was no ordinary stonemason. In fact, I could be no other than the god of the sun incarnate. The whole assembly began to sing the praises of Surya, deity of the sun. My first impulse was to tell them, "No, no, I'm only a stonemason." But seeing their joyous faces and hearing their sweet praises, I felt warmed and delighted by their adulation. Almost in spite of myself, I rose and declared, "Yes, I am Surya, God of the Sun, and you are my children. This is our place of worship." From that day, he told me, a steady stream of beautiful young maidens of the region came to serve him the most delectable feasts and vied for the honor of satisfying his every sensory desire. His benefactors multiplied, offering mountains of gold and other precious metals to build more great temples in praise of the sun god. Within the next 21 years, 665 temples were erected in his name. The worshippers at each temple rejoiced at their good fortune in being able to worship Surya, God of the Sun, in person. The fervor of their worship reached such heights that Surya was elevated into the realm of the gods. He was no longer subject to old age or death. Surya had transcended the human realm. At least he thought he had. By believing and accepting the deification thrust upon him, Surya managed to maintain the enjoyment of his divine status. However, he did it by lying to himself and then concealing his lies from those who adulated him. He made more and more preposterous promises to the people who adored him, declaring that if they truly worshipped him as the supreme deity, he would raise them too up to his level of godliness, bliss, and eternal life. They believed to their dying day that he would grant them the exaltation they desired. But Surya didn't really care about his following. All he cared about was to keep the hearts of the devotees aflame, so that the energy of their prayers, songs, and offerings would keep him forever young. Surya's extravagant sojourn into the realm of the gods continued for centuries. Eventually, through an act of extreme cunning and treachery, it began to wane. Among the seductive young worshippers who flocked around Surya, the most beautiful and the shrewdest was named Chandra. Through keen observation, she understood how he had become such a powerful god. Even more ambitious than Surya, Chandra had actually attained to the full-stated divinity herself. But although she had gained considerable influence as Surya's favorite, she was no longer satisfied being merely his consort. As her lust for power grew, a plan began to form. In secret, she gathered the droppings of the many-colored, opalescent peacocks that strutted majestically around Surya's palace grounds and perched on its roof. From this waste matter, she extracted toxins that the birds excreted after consuming highly poisonous plants, blending them into a deadly concoction that would gradually poison Surya upon ingestion. She used it to contaminate Surya's food offerings and added it to the golden cups from which he drank Amrita, nectar of the gods. She even placed a few drops into her own crevices where he liked to lick. Gradually, Surya's divine energy began to ebb. The sun was growing cold. Chandra was now increasingly the one who was supplicated by the devotees and disciples, since the worship of Surya was no longer benefiting them. While Surya was hobbling through his gardens one morning, he was seized by a coldness in his testicles and a burning in his heart. The cumulative effects of the poisoning overcame him, and he fell. He fell not just to the ground, but out of the heavens, down and down, to the greatest depths that anyone can fall. Falling from the god realm was traumatizing beyond belief. Surya was used to having every wish immediately fulfilled and enjoying immense pleasure and ever-expanding states of bliss. Reduced to a hell being, he now has to endure aeon upon aeon of severe affliction, wandering endlessly between the hot and cold hells, until he can arise in a precious human form, which alone is capable of spiritual attainments. Desolation of the Cold Hells, Mikio Suzuki. From the fiery chasms of the hot hells, the Buddha beside me turned my mind toward the cold hells. I found myself where there was neither sky nor ground, in a white world stained with soot. Almost immediately, howling winds pulled me through an icy passage. I emerged in what looked to be an earthly city, except that all the buildings were made of ice, snow, and frozen viscous liquids. It could have been the capital of the cold hells, if one utterly bleak city can be distinguished from another. In contrast to the dense crowding of the hot hells, the cold hells were made up of unending empty expanses, lonely places of stark desolation, where every being was alone and separate. In the cold hells, although the beings seemed surrounded by endless desolate space, their mindset solidifies and actually freezes until it implodes into tiny crystalline chips that continuously cut each other. Their perception shrinks into transfixation on the agonizing sores and blisters that appear when their naked skin cracks open due to the intensely cold winds. As each wound gathers the sole attention of their sufferer, it reproduces itself, creating a claustrophobia of recurring pain that jumps from one blister to the next, so that the blisters reproduce exponentially. This horror repeats itself in apparent perpetuity until their habit of icy pride or other extraordinarily bad mentation is exhausted. The population here was as immense as that of the overcrowded hot hells. However, the experience of every inhabitant here is that of being utterly solitary. Other than the howling of the biting wind, all I could hear was a bizarre rattling sound like the chattering of multitudes of teeth. But there were no beings to be seen. Suddenly, the Buddha of Hell drew my startled attention to a frail woman at my feet, curled up and unclothed on the berry ice and ground. She strained to look up and chattered her name to me. Mikio Suzuki. Mikio Suzuki's situation was terribly sad. She, who had lived a privileged life as the wife of a wealthy business executive, doing everything properly and abhorring any extremes of behavior or emotion, had now, after death, ended up in the most extreme frigid environment without even a scrap of clothing to cover her body. She tried to weakly lift her hand toward me, but I discovered that I could not extend my own toward her, despite the heart-wrenching sensation of witnessing her plight. For in fact, I had no physical form with which to reach out or touch. I had to hear the miserable stories of all those hell beings without being able to help or comfort them. Mikio Suzuki had been a social butterfly, entertaining countless guests at her lavish home and in turn being entertained by them. Her life consisted of one time-filling event after another, enabling her to stay busy and alleviate her great fear of boredom, of solitude, of silence. Despite her busyness, she had always remained aloof from any genuine human connection. Even her marriage had been like a random association of strangers, with her husband frequently away on business. There were no children. No one cared when she died. Yet, she had met many distinguished people. One visiting young couple she remembered were a delicate Korean lady and her handsome fiancé, a descendant of the Korean imperial family. She had been introduced to them at a party and learned that the couple were interested in sampling Japanese culture. The young lady told Mikio how enchanting they found the Japanese aesthetic, the way of viewing things artfully, deeply, precisely, seeing form and also seeing space. Amused by the foreigner's knowledge of her language and culture, Mikio invited them to her home to admire her fine antiques and decor. Their visit was a pleasant diversion. The pair ask questions about the Japanese tea ceremony and other arts, and Mikio proudly showed them her exquisitely manicured rock garden and some of her family heirlooms. It was gratifying that the Koreans appreciated her superior way of life. When they took their leave, with respectful bows, she wished them well for their wedding. A few weeks later, Mikio was rather taken aback to find the young lady alone at her door. Mikio politely asked her in, but did not invite her to sit down, and the two women conversed awkwardly. Then, unexpectedly, the young lady shamefacedly confessed that her fiancé had abruptly broken off their engagement. On being asked for the reason, she blurted out that he had abandoned her when she told him that she was with child. She was stranded in Kyoto with no money and nowhere to go. Tearfully, she implored, "Please, Suzuki-san, please help me. Just for the moment, I am penniless. I am waiting for my mother to send funds from Seoul. Would you kindly allow me to stay at your home for a very short time? You were so kind the other day." Mikio gaped at the broken girl who stood before her, horrified at the thought of this Korean-skinned person staying at her home. What would the neighbors think? What if the girl wanted to stay longer? She quickly said, "No, it is out of the question. My husband would never permit it. You will have to go somewhere else." The young woman trembled with distress. "But I have no one else to ask." Mikio said, "Well, I'm very sorry, but you must go somewhere else." That was the end of the encounter. She sighed with relief as she closed the door on the weeping girl. Every now and then, over the years, Mikio Suzuki felt curious about what had become of the young woman. There was no guilt over turning her away. It was not as if she had done anything improper. She'd had no choice, after all. Once her husband passed away, her social activities dwindled and finally ceased. While she lived on and on, becoming ever more decrepit until she was almost 100 years old. Most of her time had been spent alone at home, looking after her possessions, checking her bank balances. She told me she had been satisfied with that life. One day, while being taken out for a ride by her driver, she saw an odd sight: a small dog running across the street, chased by a confused old lady nearly her own age, dressed only in a nightgown. Mikio stared with distaste, then looked away. There was nothing inside her that could recognize that this vulnerable woman, someone who was old and alone like herself, might need help. Mikio Suzuki's whole life had been filled with looking away, filled with paying no attention to what she disdained, even if what she disdained was a mirror image of herself. As she got older, all of her acquaintances passed away. She dismissed her driver and remained at home, occasionally hobbling out to a nearby shop. It was midwinter when death came for her during a snowstorm. No one attended the simple funeral ceremony performed for her by a hired priest. That was how she found herself in this cold hell, where no one paid any attention to her, and she paid no attention to anyone else. She had been here for an astonishing length of time, centuries upon centuries. She told me that I was the first one who had ever made contact with her here. With a shaking hand, she pointed to a sore on her arm. It was excruciatingly painful. "Can you help me with this sore?" She explained that when she first arrived at this place, the sore appeared gradually. It did not heal, but only worsen. It throbbed painfully. Soon, it consumed all of her thoughts and attention. She was convinced that sharp ice crystals were being injected into various parts of her body. The pain was constant and increased in intensity day by day. Pain had become her intimate companion, whose every nuance she could describe in detail. After a few years, she said, something changed. It was as if this sore had become two sores. The one sore had become two, and a war broke out between them. They fought each other viciously, with the razor-sharp crystal icicles giving her excruciating pain, stabbing, shooting, pounding, searing, explosive agony. Over time, the two sores doubled, becoming four. Then the four became 16, and the 16 became 256. The magnitude of the warfare increased and increased, among infinite battling sores, all screaming with pain. Her existence was now made up of continuous battles inside one sore. She was angry because there was nothing else in her world but the painful experience of the sore splitting and multiplying, and her counting the number of subsores. She counted them over and over. 1, 2, 4, 16, 256, and on and on. The Buddha of Hell whispered to me, "This is the pain of habitually clinging to the false idea of a self separate from the rest of life and all other beings." He turned his eyes toward the sores. Because of his attention, the sores healed. But sadly, Mikio's habit was so strong that she did not even notice that someone had helped her. Her habit of inattention, of ignoring all but her own self-absorption, was too powerful. Immediately, she missed her counting. She began counting again. She counted 1. The sore reappeared. 2. The sore split into 2. 4. It split again and again and again. The Doomsday Machine, Afanas Popov. We traversed through the frozen hellscapes of giant gray crystalline mountains and through gray valleys that were barely inhabited. In an endlessly long valley lay a massive hell being. His body elongated and burst open, ghostly birds of prey circling above him. The valley echoed with his rantings and ravings. The shriek of his voice broke mountains into asteroids that flung themselves through the valley into the further depths of the cold hells. His hell body was made up of infinite numbers of other hell bodies. Each muscle, each sinew, each limb and extremity, organs and viscera, were made up of distorted figures, all experiencing the complete body of pain. Their combined pain was much more than the sum of its parts. Jana Sophia explained to me that this huge hell being had in life been a Russian physicist of great note, named Afanasy Popov, known to his friends as Afanas. He was born into a family of St. Petersburg intellectuals. His mother was a doctor. His father was an economist. As a child, Afanas was fascinated by birds, bugs, and butterflies. He was excited by trees, flowers, and grasses. Every change in the season, with its new manifestations of flora and fauna, was a thrill to him. In his teens, he began to study chemistry and physics, and he became quite accomplished in his studies. He deeply understood the physical makeup of both the animate and inanimate aspects of the world. An excellent student in college, he was awarded science prizes of all kinds. After receiving his doctorate, Popov was drafted by his government to work on secret scientific projects at a special campus that had been built in the hidden part of Central Siberia. He was quite satisfied by this offer, which gave him free rein to do whatever research he wanted. Over time, he made many scientific discoveries about the nature of time, matter, and energy. Soon, he was the most important scientist in his country, a consultant to all of its major petrochemical, mining, and banking interests. He was awarded great sums of money and great privilege, including a palatial home within the scientific community in Siberia. He became close friends with Stanislav Kaminsky, the oligarch in charge of the nation's largest munitions manufactory. They shared a love of nature and relished hunting rare tigers and leopards in the Siberian forests. Popov and Kaminsky were both seriously concerned about the future of their country and its relationship to the rest of the world. They were aware of the threats posed by China and the various Islamic republics at their borders, not to mention Europe and its ally, the United States. Both men were nationalists who longed to rebuild the glory of a Soviet empire that wouldn't crumble. After many intense conversations on this topic with Kaminsky, Popov could barely think of anything else. Because of his plenipotentiary powers, now as the head of all scientific research in his country, Popov decided it was time to build a device to sustain the empire that he was certain would be revived. He planned the ultimate weapon, a complete doomsday machine. Not something that would damage just one place or injure one group of people, but a machine that, if Russia were threatened, would destroy the entire world, exploding it into dust. In his mind, Popov saw this as a benevolent invention, because it would make Russia invulnerable and bring total order to the world. Confiding his plan only to his oligarch friend Kaminsky, he secretly arranged for many small projects around his science campus. Hundreds of scientists worked day and night to complete their projects and bring them to him. Popov had built an enormous laboratory the size of 100 aircraft hangars. All the various components were brought into this vast space. In a central section, there was a huge cast metal cage built to house the final product. It was placed deep inside the earth. The various parts of the weapon were assembled inside this metal tomb. After construction was completed, the machine was fully enveloped. All kinds of safeguards were built around it, so it could not be tampered with in any way by enemies or future governments. Popov was extremely pleased by the labor of his fellow scientists and workers in producing the spectacular protective mechanism. Many years passed. Popov enjoyed a pleasant life, having moved back to St. Petersburg. He married, fathered children, and lived the life of a mini oligarch. He was welcomed in all the halls of power and academia. His friend, the munitions oligarch, Stanislav Kaminsky, was elected the president of Russia. A year later, various revolutions broke out in dictator-dominated countries of Central Asia and the Middle East. In Pakistan, a gang of violent rebels had overtaken an Air Force base that held nuclear missiles. In their crazed religious fervor, which in fact was not piety at all, but merely the savagery of their tribal will to rule, they exploded a missile upon a northern Indian city. Immediately, Pakistan and India were at war. India had to consider retaliation. Motivated by the Pakistanis' example, a group of equally crazed Iranian terrorists managed to seize control of an experimental nuclear missile. They successfully fired it upon the small nation of Israel, almost destroying it completely, including all of the Palestinian lands, but not before Israel deployed 3 missiles upon Iranian cities. A third world war had begun in the name of a god. The Americans and Europeans were paralyzed, not knowing exactly what to do. There were riots in the streets of Europe and America. In Chechnya and Dagestan, the fearmongers were incited to destroy. There were also riots in Xinjiang, China. The world was aflame in chaos. President Kaminsky met with his closest advisors, including, of course, Popov. President Kaminsky made an announcement to the whole world that if any more bombs were detonated or if war against Russia were declared by any country, he would launch the doomsday machine to obliterate the world. He made it clear that this was Russia's ultimate gift of peace to the world, the final detente. The people of the world and their leaders were shocked by Russia's reckless audacity, but many refused to believe it, convinced that Russia was bluffing. In Dagestan, a well-organized group of extremists made plans to test Kaminsky's resolve and to possibly remove themselves from Russia's control. Years back, they had stolen a nuclear missile from Ukraine. They decided to launch it on Moscow. The missile successfully landed and exploded, destroying vast sections of Moscow, including Popov's family, who were visiting Kaminsky's relatives at the time. Chaos and disbelief broke out everywhere. Shocked and devastated by the turn of events, Popov became absorbed in the sorrow of losing his family and so many friends. In his despair, he concluded that there was no reason for him or anybody to live any longer. He was determined to use the doomsday machine to put a final end to loss for himself and everyone else. Everything would be obliterated into black nothingness. Hence, no more suffering for anybody, ever. It was the only answer. Back in Novokrasnoyarsk, he seated himself before the controls of the doomsday machine, which was receiving codes from Kaminsky and from various generals and admirals confirming its use. However, he was the final arbiter of its use. Popov slowly lifted his hand. Just as his finger was poised over the doomsday switch, he was shot dead by the soldiers protecting the facility. Everything turned blacker than black. There was nothing. It seemed that his wishful thinking had come true. In his mind, he believed that he had in fact launched the destruction of the world. Now there was no more consciousness, no people, no joy, no pain, nothing. Despite Popov's conviction that death was a final oblivion, at some point his latent consciousness rearose in the form of a crow that could see the hell body of himself that I was observing. Instead of nothingness, there was hell. Hell Popov was angry and dismayed. His body was like a hologram filled with all the bodies of hell, all the individuals of hell. There was absolutely no separation between himself and these individuals. Yet he had contempt and disgust for every part of his body that was made up of other hell beings. Even though they were no different from his own hell being, he was claustrophobized by his own fingers, his own feet, his own organs. Afanas Popov's ultimate weapon had only turned against himself, creating an appallingly hellish, continuous, frozen existence without birth or death. In an ironic twist on the deluded dualistic fantasy that there could actually be nothing, Popoff became everything, but it was everything in hell. Boxing Match of Pain, Parker Lancet. The vast expanses of the cold hells are blown by winds containing gray soot. Unlike the winter wonderlands on Earth, the cold hells are winter nightmares. The season is severe and permanent, with no change in temperature or light. Winter never transforms into springtime. A time never comes when the ice melts. No green shoots ever spring forth. No buds open. No birdsong announces the arrival of spring. Not the slightest shred of hope. Absolutely no relief. It is always winter. Dotted on the vast expanses of ice and snow are vestiges of cities and villages akin to the earthly realm. But they are uninhabited ice mirages created from the being's habits of seeing walls and windows and spires. The buildings provide no shelter or creature comforts of any kind. Cold winds blow through them without any respite. Some of the cities are like abandoned crystal palaces. Others are like deserted corridors of loneliness with the illusion of some form of society. We entered into the main street of a frozen city called Nova Urbanus. Although the city was extremely large, with streets and buildings sprawling in all directions, like a lost metropolis, there was only one inhabitant. A man was wandering endlessly through all the streets and buildings. He seemed unsure of what he was looking for. Perhaps another person, some warmth, or some food. But there was none. His relentless wandering produced a huge blister on the bottom of his foot, a crystalline blister of icy torture. The more he walked, the more he was tortured. His attention changed from the pain of his relentless wanderings to the agony of the crystalline blister. Eventually, he could feel and experience only the blister agony and nothing else. One day, after eons of blister fixation, a second crystal blister appeared next to the original one. His attention kept going back and forth, from the agony of the first blister to the agony of the second blister, and back again. He attempted to return to his habit of wandering, but when he stepped on the blisters, they cracked, and the agony was multiplied by the clusters of crystals. Not only were the clusters on his foot, but the whole world around him seemed like solid, ice-covered land, and it, too, began slowly to crack. Over years, clusters formed, vibrating with exactly the same pain as the sores on his foot. Figuratively and literally, his whole world had become an agonizing, vibrating, deadening, ricocheting, claustrophobic beyond all belief, city of horror. As we approached, he babbled out his name. He was called Parker Lancet. In his human life, he had initially been a physician, but he had cared so little about his patients that he turned to drug research so as not to deal directly with people and their suffering. As a researcher, he could confine his attention to the plain facts of chemistry and biology. His work produced various theories, and occasionally, by happenstance, a medical application for his findings was discovered. He was constantly excited by his research, and equally excited by writing grant proposals for further research. A secret project that he had been intently working on was aimed at finding the remedy for all suffering. He had actually succeeded in concocting a drug that could simply obliterate negative emotional states. How simple. How perfect. But in his excitement, Parker made the mistake of injecting himself with his formulation before it had been tested by the proper clinical protocol. The excessive dosage caused his own accidental suicide. Ironically, in his last moments, Parker had the epiphany that this was the ultimate discovery, the real solution to suffering, the final end to all emotional distress. Death. Nothingness. Apparently not. As the ground around us kept cracking, he screamed in horror because his sores were cracking further, and the agony was intensifying exponentially. Suddenly, a solid crystal underneath him shattered. Shards flew in all directions, and I watched as he fell back into his hell city, onto his hell street, the same one that we had just been standing on. And his wandering began again. It was clear that this scenario would replay endlessly. He wanders. The illusory solidity of the crystalline ice underfoot gives way. It cracks. He falls with a surge of panic. Ad infinitum. Mirage at the Periphery. Serena Tristis. Outside the hot and cold regions is an area of hell that resembles the earthly realm. This peripheral hell holds the promise that one's incarceration in hell is coming to an end. Indeed, this may be true, but there are still aeons of hellish existence ahead to plague the denizens. They are constantly fooled by seemingly ordinary, pleasant earthly phenomena, which, however, conceal hellish elements waiting in ambush. Ordinary days turn into horrifying nights. Landscapes turn into hellscapes. Entering the periphery, I beheld a scene reminiscent of a lush, spacious African grassland. Strings of lakes appeared to be glistening in the distance, offering the prospect of refreshing oneself in the pristine waters. Among those who had been trapped for aeons in the hot and cold hells and had eventually come into these seeming grasslands at the outer edges of hell was a woman named Serena Tristes. She was approaching the first lake, but as she reached the edge of it, the lake disappeared like a mirage in the desert. She was so ready to drink of its purifying water, but she found only a cracked, dry indentation. Scorpions, spiders, and fanged ants were swarming everywhere. Serena fell into great despair. She remembered that in her human life, she had had such disgust and contempt for insects during her lifetime. As a human, she was much mightier and could destroy them at will, tricking them with poisoned bait, destroying their homes, and squashing their bodies under her heel without a second thought. But here, they were the rulers of the realm and menaced all who approached. She ran away as fast as she could. She traversed further, thinking that perhaps this first lake was just dried out, hoping that the lakes in the distance were not mirages, but real, thirst-quenching water. She went to the shores of lake after lake, all completely dry. Insects and vermin of all kinds attacked her, and mangled her ghostly legs. Huge winged beetles buzzed past her ears with sonic booms that further stirred her utter despair. After years and years of chasing lakes that turned out to be mirages or dried holes in the ground, she came upon one that didn't disappear as she approached. It was almost oceanic in size, and she could see nothing but shimmering waves all the way to the distant horizon. A small ray of hope dared to rise in her mind as she stretched toward the water to drink of it. She couldn't wait to jump in and cleanse her ghastly habit body. As Serena's face moved ever closer to the water rose to meet her lips. A dank odor prevailed. Her mouth then met the water. She screamed in horror. It was not water at all. The liquid was pus, blood, and entrails of humans, animals, fish, and dying insects and vermin. A wave rose and pulled her into the currents, filled with repulsive liquids and solids, combined with the bodies of all the people and creatures that she had despised in her life. These people and creatures were misshapen, and gory fluids oozed from their bodies. There were thrown off entrails of every animal whose meat she had ever eaten, without even the thought that their lives had been sacrificed to nourish hers. She was drowning in the mixture of filth and negative emotions. Around her appeared the bobbing heads of other sufferers, struggling to spit out shreds of offal and gasp for air, only to be sucked into a slimy tunnel of filth. But although she, too, was sucked deep into the lake, there was no death for Serena. Just the constant horror of being absorbed into everything she had hated or ignored. Simultaneously with her urgent desire to drink and cure her thirst and to bathe and make herself fresh, there arose a cocktail and bath of everything she mistakenly assumed would disappear after her death. Serena was pulled deep into the bottom of the lake, which was made up of frozen caverns in which she became trapped and imprisoned, suffering from the extreme cold. Centuries passed until finally the caverns melted, and she was pulled into the substrata through a fiery drainage tunnel that absorbed her into chambers of the hot hells again. There was absolutely no escape. Just a constant regurgitation from one hellscape to the next. Serena was jostled by the hope that there was a way out, and jolted by the constant fear of meeting everyone and everything that her mind wanted to avoid. In hell, there is no avoidance. The mind imagines what to avoid, then gives power to those same feelings, images, and environments. There is absolutely no way to get off the roller coaster of hoping to be saved or fearing that which scares us most. In her human life, Serena had been a dutiful child, born into a devout family who worshipped faithfully. The dogma of the church and her parents' piety were initially an inspiration and a stabilizing influence that she depended on to build her sense of self. As she entered her teens, her friends teased her about her goody-two-shoes attitude. A growing conflict between desires that ran quite hot and a fear of retribution caused her to become quite cold in her relations with her parents and friends. While she was outwardly distant, her inner life was an intense drama of passion fighting with guilt. At some point, passion won, and she abandoned her religious beliefs and observances. The pendulum then swung in the opposite direction. Now liberated from the bonds of any external moral standard, Serena embraced a shameless lifestyle without direction. Just as she had once been dependent on a religious pursuit of goodness, she now became addicted to indulgence and escapism. Her compulsive promiscuity left her so pained that she turned to drugs and alcohol to soothe and numb herself. With no sense of discernment, she trusted fools and ill-intentioned exploiters while disdaining simple-hearted people who were friendly and good. Deep below the surface of consciousness, the battle of hot and cold raged constantly. Serena finally pushed her luck just a little too far. After drinking heavily, she left the bar with a stranger who helpfully offered to escort her home. Once there, he beat and sexually assaulted her, then choked her to death. The inner battle that was in her mind at the moment of death was her non-stop ticket to the hell realm. If only she could have cultivated a little kindness toward herself, some compassion for herself in facing her dilemma. Yearning, Luigi Giacomo. Gianna Sofia beckoned me gently to follow her, and we continued through what felt like a tropical forest. Birds called in the distance, and the rustling of leaves and other sounds betrayed the movements of living things on the ground. Then I sighted a young man running toward a grove of fragrant sandalwood trees. He was crying out, "Yes, my love. Yes, my love." From the crazed look on his face, I concluded that he had just emerged from the tortures of the hot and cold hells. He seemed convinced that he was back in the ordinary world. As he ran, he continued repeating, "Yes, my love. Yes, my love." The grove of trees seemed to glitter, beckoning him. Gianna Sofia spread her wings, and instantaneously we were inside the grove, watching what was going on. The young man's name was Luigi Giacomo. He had endured eons of suffering in the hot and cold hells, until finally the karmic force of his deeds had begun to wear out, just enough so that he could slip through a crevice into a peripheral hell like the one I had just witnessed so vividly. Like me, Luigi had emerged into a vast expanse of seemingly earthly terrain, where he perceived a normal landscape of trees, flowers, animals, and birds. In the distance, he saw a lush green forest, where he imagined he would find water and fruit to satisfy himself after ages of deprivation. Although the jungle looked quite close, as he moved toward it with his every step, the plain elongated itself several fold. Nonetheless, he was driven on by his ravenous hunger and thirst. Thousands of years passed, yet the forest kept moving away from him, moving away from him, until finally it seemed to hold still. He heard the wind blowing through the trees. He heard the sound of a waterfall in the distance. His steps quickened as he pushed on in the hope of finding sustenance. Suddenly, he heard the faint sound of someone calling his name. "Luigi! Luigi! Please come." That voice, He had not heard that beautiful voice since he was alive so long ago. Could he be hallucinating? As he went deeper through the woods, the sound of the voice became clearer. And yes, it was that voice. It was his beloved calling him. In his exhilaration, all care for food and drink vanished. He just followed that musical voice and the golden promise of reuniting with the woman he had desired so fiercely. She cried to him, "Luigi, it is I, Anna, your lover. I am stuck at the top of this tree. Please, darling, come save me. Don't leave me imprisoned here." This was the tree from which we now observed Luigi Giacomo's quest. The sandalwood was monumental in size, with countless branches, large and small, and glistening oval leaves without number. I saw that this grove of trees, which had looked so earthly, was not earthly in the least. The sandalwoods grew in a crystal and metal structure, with each branch and leaf made up of hard razor edges, and the bark itself was studded with sharp metal thorns. Luigi's beloved called to him again from above. He happily responded, "I'm here, Anna. I'm here, my love. I have come to save you." Swiftly, he began to climb, but instantly came the shock. The razor-like leaves sliced into the flesh of his torso, his arms, his face, and the thorns punctured his feet. But still, he was determined to make it to the top. The greater his efforts, the more severely he was cut, and the weaker he became. But at last, Luigi approached his goal. As he reached the crest of the tree and looked up to find his beloved Anna, he was aghast to see a giant, multicolored parrot uttering cries in Anna's voice. This was no ordinary parrot. Its beak was made of iron. The parrot struck at Luigi, its curved beak open, and bit sharply, deeply, eviscerating his very heart from his chest, plucking it abruptly like a piece of fruit. The mighty bird took off flying into the distance, blood dripping from the heart trapped in its jaws. Luigi screamed in despair and fell to the jungle floor. As a hell denizen, he could not die. He could only stumble away as a heartless zombie. Gianna Sophia intimated that this horrible scene had been the result of Luigi's own actions and thoughts, his relentless habitual craving to possess another. As Gianna Sophia lifted me high into the sky, I saw infinite groves of razor trees with infinite young men and women, each one driven by a relentless craving and lured to destruction by the deceitful speech of an iron-beaked parrot. Rebirth and redemption. Having wandered through the hot hells, the cold hells, and the peripheral hells, I now realized that the Buddha of Hell and Gianna Sophia were showing me a way to actually benefit those trapped in the various holes of hell. I had gradually become attuned more clearly to the mind of the Buddha of Hell. He constantly moved through the myriad layers of hell and marked each place that he went with a symbol of wakefulness that showed the way out and included the key to knowing how to never return to hell. Never returning to hell is associated with the fearlessness that comes from seeing clearly, without judgment, Through pure perception, there is liberation. You destroy whatever needs to be destroyed. You subdue whatever needs to be subdued. And you care for whatever needs your care, as Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche has said, but never from the point of view of ego or evil. The exit from hell has everything to do with perceiving the wisdom of compassion and caring. I was shown that simple kindness on my part, with no expectation of return, reduced the roiling in anger and despair within hell. Jana Sophia demonstrated this through the constant, caring attention that she radiated without so much as the pause of a blink. She showed me that extreme states of suffering were ameliorated through kindness projected into the innumerable individual hell beings, with the view that the suffering beings are not separate from her and the Buddha, and in fact have the latent possibility to be just like them. Through the subtle change from duality habit to a non-dualistic continuum, thoughts of loving kindness and care, with no reference back to oneself, actually heal and provide support. Her pure caring and compassion, directed toward any individual hell being, benefits all the suffering individuals because all are interconnected. At this point, I heard deep belchings emanating from the depths of countless hollows in the cavernous terrain. The belchings turned into a strong, continuous sound that was harmonious and deep. The Buddha of Hell blessed me with his mind, and my habit body was pulled into the blazing flames of Jana Sophia. I felt my consciousness engulfed by a warm, womb-like environment, along with the individual consciousness of each being with whom I had made mental contact in hell. As our consciousness was squeezed through a moist, pink, narrow passage, we are purified of the mental concepts that cause us to perceive a personal hell according to each individual's subjective habit patterns. It felt as if, through the mercy of Jana Sophia, endless possibilities lay before us to be free from addiction to the repetitious rounds of suffering that characterize samsara. Now, released from these hellish conceptions, we were each reborn into a higher realm according to individual karma. Most of us entered human forms, while others ascended to the higher realms of demigods and gods. For me, it was the close of a brief guided journey. For them, deliverance from imprisonment in the worst of hells. Each of us had learned that to cease holding extreme views of reality was the beginning of wisdom. Our deep contemplation of the true nature of suffering had brought with it the gift of clear seeing. This was the new, brilliant space into which I was reborn.